All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck sticks? What the fuckadelics? What the fuckleberry fins? What the fuck puddles? I don't even know what that one means. I don't know what that means. Never said it. What the fuck puddles? I don't know if that really describes a person. It was just something that came out. Welcome to the show. I am Mark Maron. This is my show. This is WTF. Today, my guest on today's show is Richard Linklater, the director of Boyhood and many other movies. Many other movies. Slacker. Come on. Dazed and Confused. School of Rock. Waking Life. The Before Midnight, After Sunrise, Sunrise, Midnight, Sunrise Today, the next day. Forget the name of that series. Those movies. He did Fast Food Nation. He's done a lot of movies, this guy. So I'm going to talk to him in a minute. For those of you who are just joining me this week of Amazing Modern Directors and don't really know me, I've quit my last addiction for the most part. I've gotten off of nicotine lozenges. I haven't smoked in a long time, but now I'm without nicotine and we're over 5 weeks now. And the rawness is making me crazy. Do not like being this open. Do not like not having a damper, a filter, a way to keep level. That's the one thing about self-medicating, keeps you nice and level. So where's it going to pop up next? I'm drinking tea, not drinking coffee. So that's it. So I got tea and I'm trying to manage the masturbation. Don't want to get into that, go down that addictive rabbit hole, because that's a very sad one. They're all kind of sad, but some are more socially acceptable than others. You can certainly kind of suck on nicotine lozenges and drink a lot of caffeine. But you know, you can't just break down and jerk off at work. Well, you can, but it's not good. There's not a lot of pride in that. Relationship is going pretty well. But I think what's happening is I just don't know how, I have no way to calibrate my emotions. And when things in the world, which I don't address that much on the show in terms of what my feelings are, because I don't want to come off as righteous. For selfish reasons, I think a lot of righteousness is self-serving, and I find it despicable. A lot of stuff weighs very heavy on me. It's hard for me to process the fact that one of my heroes is some sort of sociopathic evil monster. It's hard for me to process the horrendous torrents of racism in this country. It's hard for me to process the fact that religious fanatics go into an office and blow away a bunch of artists and cartoonists. It's all fucking horrible. And on top of that, raccoons are digging up my yard. And that's the one that's closest to me. All this other stuff filters in, and then I have irrational reactions to things like dropping a cup or raccoons digging up my yard, because all this stuff is bottled up in me, all these feelings of hopelessness and of anger about the way the world works. Yeah, I could spend my life talking about it, but to me it's all evil, and all I can do, well, the raccoons aren't evil, they're just being raccoons. Human-based behavior is evil. Animals, not so much. They're annoying, they're destructive, but generally there's not a moral, we can't attach some moral imperative to fucking raccoons tearing up my yard. Raccoons do not say, fuck this guy, let's pull up his sod. And I'm not even that hung up on the grass. I just don't know what to do about it, really. And it makes everything stink. And it just amplifies the hopelessness of everything. And things are going well for me right now. But I'm telling you, man. I'm telling you. Shit can get kind of dark. And now that I don't have nicotine to manage the fucking fluctuations of my feelings, or at least to keep them, you know, tamped down, I'm worried that I'm going to unload on somebody. I'm worried that I'm going to unload on myself. I'm worried that, you know, I'm just going to say some fucking shit that's going to cause trouble. And a lot of people like that. See, a lot of people, I don't even know how concerned they are about things necessarily. They're more concerned about, where do you stand? Where are you on this? Let's judge you about where you stand on something. I usually stand for decency and rational behavior. I'm generally against evil. I'm having a problem with raccoons right now. I'm also having a problem with my fucking confidence. It's horrendous. You think after a certain point, you know, you You get everything up and going. Things are going well. Your people enjoy what you do. Like, when do you just sort of like, hey man, I'm great. When does that happen? It's like the fucking opposite is happening. And that's always why I go back to nicotine or go back to whatever, go back to setting my brain on fire somehow. So at least my brain is on fire and I don't have to deal with what's in my heart. If your brain is on fire, your heart just sits there sadly and watches your brain burn. Fine. So I'm a little emotionally all over the place and I'm just trying to keep that out of the realm of sad. That's the big agenda of sad and like, what's the point? Nothing is true. Things are out of control. My heroes are liars and people are killing people for cartoons. Fuck. When I get into this place of being emotional, all I can do is say, well, what the hell happened? What happened? And that's the amazing thing about Linklater. You know, I had Paul Thomas Anderson on here, and his movies demand understanding from you. And you can create whatever understanding you want. They're very provocative in that way. They're minimal enough. They leave a lot of room in them for you to sort of, you know, either project your own ideas onto them or let them live within you until they make sense to you. But Linklater seems to be in certainly in movies like Slacker or Dazed and Confused and the Midnight and Sunrise movies. And now this film, Boyhood, seems to be really sort of hung up and concerned with how people move through time. How does time affect us? That's the amazing thing about Boyhood. I mean, I saw this film. It's basically about a family and about, you know, their struggles emotionally. There are some harrowing emotional elements of it, but it's not a tragic tale. But the fact that he used the same actors over a 12-year arc, you know, returning back to shoot scenes as they got older, it leaves you with a very interesting feeling. And I still cannot put my finger on what that feeling is. Knowing that these are the actors that were there 12 years ago and moved through their lives, you know, for that 12 years, watching them grow up, all of the characters get older, 12 years older over the course of this 2-hour film, is something I've never seen before or felt before. And it's very strange. And I can't really identify how it made me feel. Knowing that, I mean, yeah, I mean, some of you and I've seen documentaries where they check back with people, but this is a straight narrative through a 12-year arc using the same people. It's never happened before. And I think it made me, I think there's some wish fulfillment. Yeah, there's some part of me and maybe some part of you. I'd love to see my last 12 years in a nice, tight 2-hour bit of business, a well-edited 2-hour movie. I would love to see what the hell happened over the last 20 years of my life, well edited, starring me, and maybe I could sort of figure out how I got here. I think there's a craving. It creates a craving for that because I'm constantly going back in my mind. It's not even nostalgia. It's just as you get older, you lose touch with who you were. Or maybe if you're on Facebook, you ever get on Facebook and see the people that you haven't seen in 15 years and wonder like, holy fuck, I knew that person as a kid. I knew myself as a kid, but I don't know that kid anymore. I've got some of that kid's stuff here, but I don't know, you know, what was important to him. And it just keeps getting further and further away and starts all that stuff that once defined you starts to just sort of just peel away. And I think there's something fascinating about the way Linklater makes movies like that, especially this last movie. It really says a lot about the reality that life is finite and not that long. And, you know, what we define the sort of monumental elements of our life, the life-changing things, are just days. They're just days. Things go wrong. Things go good. You bounce back. You don't bounce back. You plow on. And then it's fucking over. God, I don't want to be morose because I'm not talking about that movie. That movie is a very life-affirming film. But it's fascinating, you know, to see it play out that way. I don't think it's ever been done before. I'm looking forward to talking to him. I'm okay, people. It's just like, I don't want you to think that the things that happen in the world don't have an effect on me and don't fuck me up and break my heart. I just tend to sort of keep it local. Fucking raccoons are ripping up my yard. God damn it. Before we talk to Richard Linklater, I want to mention that Boyhood is now available on Blu-ray, DVD, and digital download. If you haven't seen it, I would do that. All right, so let's talk to Richard Linklater. This is a very different conversation with a very different director than Monday, and I hope you enjoy it, and I'll talk to you on the other side.
Yeah, you don't have time to do everything, so,
right.
You know, give it a few years.
Let
12 of your best friends that you trust their taste, when they say, hey, you when they give you that look, you haven't seen that
right.
yet, you have to, and like, okay, finally, I give up. I will read that book, see that TV show, watch that.
Whatever. So you say give it a decade, maybe.
Yeah, maybe a decade. Maybe a decade.
I believe you, man. There is so much shit, especially with music, because I got into vinyl again recently. I had no idea it even existed.
Mm-hmm.
Because you get... It's the same with movies and TV, too. Well, TV's specific, but I mean, you get locked into what you grew up with, what's coming into your head, and that's it, man. And
you start there, and your filter only goes out so far.
You need taste. Freak has to come wake you up.
What could clean the slate and start you from another entry point into the culture and in your world,
right.
and you would be, you know, you run into people who've, like, never...
You need that guy.
You need that. But even that, you're getting their entry point.
But it might be... But it might be a completely different world.
That's yeah.
Like they're a portal.
New entry point
That gets you. Like,
but you realize just how little time there is in this life and how much we go through just oblivious and blind. And,
because we're trying to feed something.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it seems like your movies are reckoning with that. You know, like, because I was thinking about it. Like, even when I was thinking about Slacker, you know,
mm-hmm.
and when that came out, it was sort of like, what is this? This is the thing. But there was a lot of that shit. Like, Austin, to me, struck me at that time. I mean, how old were you, 20?
No, I mean, when I did Slacker, I started that. I was later 20, 28.
All right. But it seemed to me, it seemed to be just a city full of those portals of people doing that weird shit. And, like, because the one thing that stands out in my mind is the dude that says that TV set's been on since 19, whenever. That he'd been keeping that set going because, you know... Those guys exist.
I know. That was really represented my 20s. You know, I had, you know, like post-college, post-work, I was hanging out, and suddenly I found myself in a town with just an incredible group of people and energy, and it wasn't about money or getting ahead. It was just about living the life you were supposed to. That's what I saw. I'm sure
art
it was
life,
there.
Though, kind of.
Yeah, people who were kind of... What's the German word? Liebenkünstler. It's an artist of life.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's like their art is the way they go through the world. They're not necessarily creating a product you can buy or sell, but it's their life is art. And I met so many people I would put in that category.
Well, you felt that.
Yeah.
And like, I grew up in Albuquerque. So like there was definitely that. Mm-hmm. I'm starting to notice it around here though. Like, it was weird. I made this note in the car today where I'm like, your early movies were, this may not ring true. It might ring true. It was how people move through time, and now the later movies is how time moves through people.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. I like that.
Right?
Yeah.
But like, did you find at that time, you didn't grow up in Austin, though?
No. No one grows up there. It's the kind of place you move to.
Well, where'd you grow up?
Kind of in the Houston area, but I lived in a small town in East Texas called Huntsville, which is where they where they do the executions of you know, mentally retarded people and grandmothers.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it's where the big prison is. My dad lived in Houston. My mom was teaching at a school in Huntsville. So I kind of had both big city, Houston, huge
city. So they weren't together for your whole life?
They divorced when I was really young.
Yeah.
About 6 or 7.
Yeah. So your mom was doing what?
Academic. You know, she was getting her degree and, you know, master's degree. So I grew up with her kind of a student. And then she kind of came into her own as a teacher. And we moved around based on our teaching jobs, and a lot like the movie Boyhood.
I was just going to say that.
Kind of an intelligent, passionate woman who kind of took her kids through, you know, her life. You know, she didn't have a choice.
That was very striking in the movie, actually, that, you know, when you really realize, and I've only been realizing it lately, I didn't grow up with it. Right. I grew up with a different type of emotional chaos, that these are young people, the parents. And, you know, you know, they're going to be fragile and vulnerable and subject to their own emotional insanity.
They don't have the answers.
Right.
Yeah.
When did you... It's a hard thing to realize, isn't it?
As a kid, it takes a while to realize. And sometimes I'm still realizing it. I think once you become a parent, it drags you through not only your own childhood again, but your own parents' relation changes. I like these generational conversations that it takes 20 plus years to get an answer or to realize something from your own childhood or
like
what your parents might have been going through.
How old are your kids?
I have a 21-year-old.
Really?
Lorelai, who's in the movie Boyhood. She's the older sister.
Oh, okay.
And then I have two 10-year-old girls. So all girls. Mm-hmm. But that's a pretty good gap in time. But
so what has changed in your relationship? Now, I have to assume that what you went through as a child with your mother was not as intense as what happened in the movie, or was it?
Well, yeah, it kind of was.
Oh, yeah?
You know, yeah, sure.
So your mom kind of got saddled with a drunk, abusive man?
Well, that was definitely my point of view. You know, I mean, the movie enforces a kid's point of view. So what the reality is I experienced might be two slightly different things, her reality.
But sure, but there are indicators that point of view would indicate that this person is an abusive person.
Well, not, you know, define abusive. You know, I think there's some good qualities there. He's not really...
Right.
He doesn't punch anyone. He's got his issues. I think a lot of people grow up where, you know, I remember that was kind of one of the things of my childhood. We're always on the... In school or sometimes even in the house in certain situations, you're kind of on the cusp of physical violence.
Well, you're terrified. If you're with an explosive person that's erratic, you walk around going, oh, God, don't. I hope it doesn't.
I think it's a more gentle society now. But like even then, I grew up getting spanked in schools. You'd do the smallest violation and you'd get paddled. And it was just a more violent culture. So I think everyone's a lot nicer now, which is a good thing. You know,
people are more aware.
You can't beat your children.
Right. They're more aware that maybe there's another way.
Yeah.
But then there's still people that would argue, nah, the old way's fine. I'm fine.
Those are the people who still, whip their kids. And,
right.
Yeah, like, hey, it worked for me. Look how great I turned out.
Right.
So that's how I'm going to treat my kids.
Yeah. You know? I grew up a child abuser.
Yeah.
Yeah. I beat the shit out of my kids. My dad.
It worked for my dad to me. It's going to work for you. Yeah. It's like the people who really have no introspection or any thought of maybe there's progress in the world on how we treat each other.
You don't have to hit kids.
Yeah. You don't have to. I mean, there's reason and there's other...
Sure.
Systems of reward and punishment.
So you never hit your kids?
Are you kidding? No. I mentally screw with them, but I don't. You know.
Yeah, that's the way to do it. So, all right, so your dad was in the big city. What was he doing? Mm-hmm.
He was in the insurance, like the movie, a guy who ended up in the insurance business. You know, just, you know, a smart guy who... had a family to support.
So this is really an autobiographical movie all the way through, in a way.
Well, largely, but it's kind of, I'm not afraid of autobiography. It's kind of the impulse of so many of my films, because I'm always filtering it through, in this case, a contemporary setting.
Right.
And in all the actors I'm working with. So I think it's a good first impulse.
Yeah.
It's where I start from. But I can't say at the end of the day, everything in it is,
right.
You know, it's not. So specifically, but it's certainly the jumping off point.
The emotional.
Yeah.
The core momentum. Of
it. Yeah. I feel that close to it, but I'm not so vulnerable like, oh, it's so autobiographical. It's because it's, Patricia's mom was kind of like that. And, you know, Ethan's dad was kind of like that. And all the ideas kind of swirl around and it becomes something a few degrees away.
Well, how open was that conversation with these actors? I mean, you were working with them for how long? It was 12 years?
Yeah, we put in our 12 years on it, and it's pretty amazing to be able to shape a character over that big a arc in a canvas.
Well, how structured was it from the beginning? You said,
very
look,
structured.
We're going to do this. If everybody lives.
Yeah, if we all are lucky to be here 12 years from now, here's what we'll have.
So you shot it in increments over what?
Roughly once a year for 12 years.
And you'd shoot for what, 3 months?
No, just a few days.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was an intense shoot. I mean, it would be several weeks of
all scripted.
Making the movie. Yeah. Yeah, but again, I would work on the script, and then I rehearse a lot. I work with the actors, and it's not like acting exercise rehearsal. It's more like rewriting and working the dialogue and the ideas through the actor, because what I'm going for is a very realistic performance.
So you let them follow their own impulses?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I'm there to to go, hey, that works, or let's think about this, or have new ideas. So I'm very process-oriented.
Do you record all that?
No, I just have pen in hand.
Just hang out?
And a laptop nearby. And
you're just hanging out with the actors?
Uh-huh. Talking, reading through scenes, having more ideas, finding humor, you know.
The experience of watching it was fairly fascinating because the story is what it is, but the phenomenon of what you did is something that I've never seen or felt before. I mean, you can see a documentary. What was it, that one with the British kids or what?
The 7-Up series,
right?
Where every 7 years you revisit people and
but that's
see that
different.
They're...
I mean, you're
it's
actually,
a documentary, yeah,
right? But you're moving through this narrative over this period of time with these same people growing. It was like
aging,
growing
up. Yeah,
it was a little. I didn't know how to feel.
Oh,
man.
Good. Yeah, because the film's really about time, you know, and it hit me in a flash like this, why can't I make this movie? I just saw the whole finished movie in my head, and it was everyone in it was just 12 years goes by, the kids grow up, the adults age from their, you know, maybe late 20s to early 40s or whatever the ages would be. And you see this progression of time, how it would work through this family. And I just felt that. And that was the cool idea for the story I was hoping to tell, what I was hoping to express about growing up and parenting and all that. But that was...
But then you were able to get these actors to commit to it and make it happen within 2 hours. I mean, that's the mind fuck there. Is that you know that these actors have had this life over the last 12 years. I mean, Christ, Ethan's been in a few movies. Maybe even some of yours, one or two of them.
We've done other movies. Right. We had 5 kids between us.
Yeah, and you know that.
Yeah.
But like to sort of condense it into this into this process of narrative and of this finite amount of screen time, there was something... Like, there was something mind-blowing about the emotion that you feel to witness it. I've never seen anything like it, so I didn't know how to feel. How did you feel about it when you watched it?
You know, I bet the whole thing, because it's really these intimate little moments, you know, most epic.
But it's the same people. It's bizarre.
Yeah, they just
It's never been done before.
They get older. Yeah, and I
has it?
I bet the form. No, not in a narrative. I'm pretty sure it hasn't, because the film came out in July now. And you don't know. It's like a scientist publishing your
paper, right, sure.
And you just put it out there and others can, and you know, I expected film historian, you know, to be at the Berlin Film Festival and some old critic.
Done.
Actually in Finland from 57 to 68, young, you know, they'd follow, you know, lay it on me. I had never seen this film before and it felt completely original to me.
No one's laid it on you yet?
Not yet. It's almost
right,
been
man.
6 months.
So all right.
The test or whatever that is going through. But it felt original, but I mean, you know, 12 years later, I can tell you, I think, why no one has ever done this, because it's just wildly impractical.
Yeah.
The amount of time and, you know, how you would do it. It's really hard to raise the money and all that stuff. And then on a psychological level, I think it's unlikely because most filmmakers were sort of control freaks.
Yeah.
The same way a writer or anyone is. You want to shape the material. And in this case, we were all having to give away a little bit of that control to our collaborator here was an unknown future. You know?
Right.
It's like the way you perceive the future as you go through your life.
Right.
You have a 12-year, you know, where are you going to be 12 years from
sure,
now?
Sure, I don't know.
And you go, you know, I have some goals or some thoughts to that.
Yeah.
And if you're lucky, you're here, but it won't be maybe exactly what you thought. But you're working toward it. So that's how we had to approach this movie. It's like, I can't tell you exactly what some of the details are going to be year 10, because we haven't gotten there. I don't know. Something big
could
happen.
So you were writing it as it went along?
Yeah, of course. I had the structure, and that was the autobiographical element, like the family moving, new jobs, the bigger structure. I mean, I knew the last shot of the movie, and I had a beginning and end, and kind of the bigger bones of how you would describe your life.
Yeah, right.
But the minutia
had to be.
I had a year to fill in that. Every year, I could go through my life thinking like, okay, oh, that. Or memories. Every year, I'm going like, fifth grade. What went on that year? What was I thinking?
Right.
And then I'm also in touch with my young actors, you know, throughout the year. Well, one's my daughter, so I'm really know her well.
Yeah.
But like, oh, things will go on at school, and like, oh, that'll trigger a memory of mine.
Was that guy pursuing acting, your actor?
Yeah, yeah. I thought that was important at the very beginning in casting Eller Coltrane. He was a young man. He was like six.
Yeah.
He had been in a movie and some commercials. He had an agent, you know, a little headshot.
Sure.
You know, I thought that was important that the family had expressed some support for that endeavor because, you know, we were heading off on a long journey. And if I would have just scooped some kid off the sidewalk and put him in a movie, they could easily come back and say, you know, he never wanted to do this.
Sure.
But at least I thought this was a better chance out of the gate to only deal with kids who seemed to have enjoyed being an actor, who had the family support. And that would create a situation more likely to make it to the end.
So this all had to be conceived over this arc of 12 years, but you had to sort of, you know, write the, you know, things that needed to happen in terms of what happened in the culture and also in terms of what happened in their life. Well,
yeah.
So
that was the fun part, the process of writing. Like when you write a movie, the order is you write it, you cast it and shoot it,
right,
and then you edit it and then it's done. Where this was like, every year I got to write it, shoot it, edit it, and then, you know, maybe put it on the shelf for 5 months and then come back and look at it and think about it and then think about next year and what else might, what's going on in the world. So it was just it was 12-part process, but it was really fun to spend those years just, you know, when you're working on something, everything's channeling into it. All your ideas are, you know, so I could go through my life going, any notion of parenting or any memory of childhood could maybe find a place in this.
Well, I mean, but how did you feel the final thing was? What was the effect it had on you? I know you've been in it, but like, see, I'm confounded by it because it doesn't feel like a regular movie because you walk in knowing this thing. I don't know what it would have been like if I walked in not knowing that.
I've talked to some people who don't know anything. They go in and.
And what's their reaction?
It really screws with their head. It's kind of great.
Because they're sitting there going like, is that the same guy?
Yeah. I've had people go, how did they catch? They're just trying to figure it out. Like, oh, where the movie starts. It's like, oh, it's a period film. Like, oh, look at that computer. Look at that game. This is a period piece. And then it slowly catches up. And they go, oh, they've cast another kid that looks a lot like, how'd they do that? And so they're an hour in when they realize, oh, okay, this is all the same people and it's... I see what's going on here. But that's kind of beautiful that you could be so, you know, virginal, I guess, and have that experience.
Well, it's interesting that, like, to me that you like this emotional movement through time. Like, it seems to be thematic with you that there seems to be something, even with Slacker, that, you know, the story is not relevant.
Yeah, there's no...
And you know, I don't know if you like going back to that. Or
there is
or
no story.
No, I know. There's no story, but there are encounters, there are movements, you find yourself wanting to get invested with certain people, and then they go away.
They drift.
Yeah, but that must have been where you were at. But what you were trying to sort of do on screen was figure out how you move through this time.
I like that you're talking about Slacker, because it is kind of related in some weird storytelling narrative sense.
It seems like it is.
It was an early idea of mine that I had in my early 20s when I was first getting into film that felt, again, kind of an original, a new way to tell a story I hadn't seen before. You know, I came to cinema thinking it was the Wild West, you know, like it was wide open territory. I really thought there were new ways to tell stories that I hadn't seen, and what's unique about cinema and how it relates to time and structures.
Where did all this hammer you? Like, I mean, so you made Slacker when you were 28. What were you doing before that?
I was watching movies and thinking about cinema. Well, I was making shorts and I was shooting a lot of
film.
Did
you go to film school?
No, I took a couple classes, but I didn't. I was kind of on my own.
Where'd you go to school?
Sam Houston State, a little school in East Texas.
Yeah.
I was in and around... I went to the Austin Community College a little bit, took a few classes there.
You never got a degree in anything.
No. I'm a student for life, though.
Good for you. I'm proud of you.
But I really do think a lot about storytelling and cinema and narrative and the possibilities and the structures and time. And, you know, I'm the kind of guy who there's a million stories in the world, but it's like how to tell them. So I was always excited about new forms.
Well, it's interesting because with Slacker, you can just walk into the middle of someone else's story and then walk out. Mm-hmm. Don't need to finish anything there. Yeah. Not necessary.
Well, I was trying to actually capture, I mean, it was a couple levels what I was thinking at that time was like, well, A, I hadn't really could you tell a story that would go from one character to the next interlinked? But I think what I was trying to capture was how your mind processes a day. You know, you talk to someone like we're here now talking, but at some point in the future, I'm going to get back in my car and go somewhere. You know, like you can't get out of your own little sequence.
Yeah, and there's
your
also,
life started when you became conscious at age three or whatever, and you're on a sequence you can't escape from.
Right, and there's also what's going on inside your head and what's going on in actual reality.
Yeah,
that's a completely fucked up thing.
Two different things. Yeah, yeah. There's this physical reality in front of you, but I was thinking in that was processing the people you meet, the encounters, the way time you drift through it, and you process the world around you and try to make sense of it.
Yeah,
and you're only grabbing in Slacker's case a few minutes of someone's life, an encounter, and it always blew me away that people said, "Oh, they don't work," or they were drawing these huge conclusions based on a 3 minute. 5 minute.
Right.
Like, you don't know if the, how do you know they're not
That's
on their
right.
way to work? Two people have anti-work crusade. You know, they
wanted to hang some on you.
Manifestos or something.
I forgot about that.
It's kind of funny. But we do judge people because that's all we can do. You know, we're trying to make sense of the world.
But they hung something on you. Make it comprehensive. Right. But they took that movie because it was a provocative movie and no one had ever seen anything like it. And, you know, it came out of nowhere in a way. And you were this independent filmmaker. And then all of a sudden you represented, that movie represented a generation.
That was crazy.
It was crazy.
That was insane.
It's still used. I mean, you know, it's still sort of.
Yeah, the term was thrown around and that you kind of.
So how do you get to that point? So you're in Huntsville.
Yeah.
You're doing your thing. What kind of kid were you? I mean, were you just like, were you interested in the arts? Were you like, did you actually have two sisters?
I have two older sisters, and, you know, my kind of an academic family. We didn't have any money at all. There was no summer camps or vacations or anything, but, you know, education was important, and arts were important. You know, my mom painted, my grandparents were kind of artists in their own way, and we went to museums and movies and culture, you know,
great.
It was the stuff you could do cheap and free. My dad on weekend, he was kind of a weekend dad, but we went to a lot of museums.
In Houston.
So, yeah.
Good museums
yeah, good
in
museums.
Houston.
Good museums, yeah. So, you know, the zoo, museums, it was always, you know, cultural. They cared about our souls, I guess, you know, in that regard. So, I grew up writing. I thought I would, I just wanted to express stories and characters. And I was writing plays in junior high even.
Putting them on?
Not really, just writing.
Yeah.
And sometimes the school would perform or we'd do readings.
Right,
and
right.
I had a gift for dialogue. And at a young age, I would win the short story contest.
Or, right, right.
You know, I was that guy. But I was also, parallel to that, I was an athlete. You know, I was happened to be, it's embarrassing, but I was kind of like one of the better athletes. You know, I was a quarterback on the football team. I was the, you know, baseball player. I went to college on a baseball scholarship. So I had this kind of dual world, but I kind of, at age 17, I was like, I want to play in the major leagues baseball and be taken serious as a novelist. You know, I want to write books, and I failed in both of those things in my life. But
but you made these great movies.
I discovered movies somewhere. Yeah. You know, around
do you remember
age 20.
Where?
Well, growing up in East Texas, it wasn't really the idea that you could make a movie, especially when I grew up.
Yeah,
everybody knows that now. Everybody's a filmmaker. Everybody knows what a director
is. You can do it with your phone.
But yeah.
But
back then, it was prohibitive. It was expensive.
How old are you?
I'm 54.
So you're 2-3 years older than me. So we grew up in the same.
Yeah,
like, I knew it because like Dazed and Confused. I'm like, I know that. Place.
Yeah, we're the same generation.
Yeah.
So it took me a while to discover that was my medium. I had this visual thing, and it clicked. I was writing, you know, short stories and plays at the moment. I really felt I was discovering cinema, and once I did that, I never looked back. But it's still a long process.
Do you remember what movie it was? What made you believe?
It was no one movie. It was just kind of falling in love with cinema in general. You know,
there's
two different levels. You know, there's films that make you love movies, but those aren't the kind of movies you think you can make.
Well, what movies were?
It was independent films that I saw in the early '80s. Very low budget, some early John Sayles movies. Chan is Missing. I can just list all the indie films that played at theaters then, and foreign films too.
Were you driving into Austin
Truffaut
to see him?
No, I was living. I had moved back to Houston. I was an offshore oil worker for like 2.5 years. What would have been my junior and senior year of college, I got a job working. I was just kind of working on oil rigs,
really
saving up my money. Yeah, it was a good experience.
Wait, you go out on the out in the water?
Yeah, you fly out there in helicopters and hang out there for a week to 15 days sometimes. And
so you got a head full of Truffaut and you're out on the
water. And I'm reading. I'm reading the library when I wasn't working. So I got a lot of reading time. But on land, I noticed I was just, what did I do today? I read till noon and then I went to four movies. I was kind of falling in love with cinema.
What do you do as an offshore oil rigger?
I was working with subsurface safety valves. I was kind of the grunt laborer.
What does that mean? You underwater?
No, you're on the rigs, but you're dropping tools down into the wells. They're very deep, but they have the well heads are up on those platforms.
Right.
So when I see Deepwater Horizon, explode, I worked on the elements that are trying to keep it safe. You have a safety valve. If the rig falls over in a hurricane, that it seals and doesn't explode. So
right.
When I've always been really aghast at something. I said, you know how many things have to go wrong for that to happen? It's all about safety and stuff. So it's horrible when that happens.
That's a hell of a job.
Yeah. A little, people say, was that dangerous? I'd like, no, I only knew one guy who got killed in my 2 years. So I don't know if it's that dangerous.
How did he get killed?
Oh, a fire.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, really sad. He was a friend. I think about him to this day fairly regularly. And he would just graduate. We were kind of the college boys. I'd been to 2 years of college, which is a little rare.
Yeah.
And he had just graduated with a degree in sociology. You know, what do you do with a sociology degree? You know, he lucked into a job just the way I did, saving up money, not sure what to do with life. And then he worked on another rig, but we would come back through a hookup. And I went back one time to the same rig he worked on and said, hey, did you hear about Jimmy? Yeah, no, there's a fire. He, died. I was like, really? So I always think, one of those sad little things the rest of your life, you think you're living a life that he's not able to lead.
Was he the first guy that you kind of knew like that who
We all had friends in car wrecks and stuff.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
There's cancer in car wrecks. I lost friends growing up. But
high school car wrecks.
Yeah, that's kind of messed up too. So it's amazing any of us survived those years, but the odds are we will.
So you were after a new way of telling a story and doing something different with cinema,
which you did, and
in Dazed and Confused, which I thought, like when I saw that, I was like, all right, he's polishing it up a little. and your attention to detail was spectacular because it was a period piece, and it was my period.
Yeah, 70s rock and roll.
Yeah, man.
Thin Lizzy.
Yeah, exactly. And everything looked familiar to me because Albuquerque was similar.
There was
a place you'd go drive into the mountains and you'd party, and it was all the same.
What do teenagers do? You drive around, you try to be cool, you find a place of your own
because
you can't. You're not going to be in your house on a Friday or Saturday night. Looking for something to do, Bond.
McConaughey. You found that guy.
There's a guy like that in every town. That's why people love that character of Wooderson so much. And Matthew so owned that guy because he came in on an audition and said, hey, I'm not this guy, but I know this guy.
And everybody,
I know this guy. And he just became that character, that guy who's sort of hanging out.
Oh, yeah, man.
Maybe he has a job, but he's still dating high school girl. He gets cooler the older, like the guys who couldn't date a girl their own age.
Yeah.
But pretty soon, by the time you're a senior, freshmen just think you're cool because you're older and maybe you have a car.
Right.
So you have to go to the younger girls.
He's a couple years away from creepy.
Yeah.
It's
going to get creepy here.
Yeah.
We figured, he's like 22.
Right.
23.
He's
but once
you're
25,
it's
over. And you usually just find the last one and marry one, before it gets too
creepy.
Where'd
you cast that thing?
Where I lived, in Austin.
Was it McConaughey an Austin guy?
Yeah, he was a UT film student.
Really?
Yeah.
So you kind of discovered that guy.
Well, I never really believed that word because...
Right. Well, you're the first to use him.
In that way. I think he'd been in a couple commercials and his destiny was laid out. I was just there at the beginning.
Are you friends?
I talk to him all the time.
You do?
Yeah.
Because, is it a Texas thing or you just buddies?
I don't know. We're two guys from East Texas,
He grew up near you?
Well, not really. East Texas is pretty large. It's,
it's
up and down, but similar town, similar thing. And our families were close. We knew each other about 5 years before we realized, get this, our dads played on the same college football team. not only were they on the same team, they played the same position. They were both defensive ends in the early 50s for the University of Houston Cougars.
Really?
Matthew and my dad. Isn't that crazy?
Both of your dads?
Yeah, they were on the same team. Matthew's dad passed away while we were making Day, so I never met him.
Uh-huh.
But my dad is still with us, and I asked him, you know, years in, because Matthew said his dad, and I was like, do you ever play with a guy, you know a guy, McConaughey? He goes, yeah.
Yeah.
He'd beat me out for the starting position one week, and I'd beat him out the next. And I'm like, that's Matthew's dad. And he goes, oh, gosh, I never put that together.
That's
funny. Funny?
Is your dad still in Texas?
We go back, yeah. Yeah, I just talked to him.
And your mom?
84. Yeah. Yeah, she's still in Texas, back in Huntsville.
Really?
I'm lucky. I'm really lucky at this age.
I got
weird.
Both of mine, too.
Yeah, I just, you know, it's that stage of life, but I'm grateful, you know, that...
Well, you know, you talked a little bit about how, you know, making the movie and also living the life has, you know, changed your relationship with these people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, having your own kids and then putting it on screen, some of that stuff emotionally anyways.
Yeah.
What has changed between you and your mother? What is it?
What
exactly?
Is it?
Is it forgiveness? Is it
a deeper... It's understanding. It's okay. Kind of like, you know, like... You look at the best qualities of your parents, and you'd like to think you inherited them, or you're aware of those in yourself. You'd like to think. My mom was very passionate and very, you know, kind of get things done. Kind of a manipulator, too.
Yeah.
Like, hey, we're going to build a patio this weekend.
Yeah.
Right. Like, I kind of want to just, like, watch TV and not do much. Oh, no. You know, she would get you working. And you need that as a director. Hey, let's put on a show.
Yeah.
Hey, you can do this, and you know, you have to be kind of a manipulator.
Uh-huh.
So she was good at that.
Yeah.
But very passionate, you know, followed that. You know, my dad's very level-headed and rational. He's uh-huh. the ultimate. I don't know what they were doing together, but they got about a 10-year marriage and 3 kids out of the deal until
uh-huh.
I think they weren't meant for
up.
Each other. Yeah.
Sure.
But I like my dad's level-headedness, and I was able to, I think, grab some of that. Cause, you know,
but did
you
always
kind
of
pragmatic.
Get along with them?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean... You know, varying degrees of alienation at certain points, but never a hostile situation.
Right.
Or I felt they were, in general, supportive of... I mean, it got a little... In my 20s, I think they just didn't understand what I was doing. Like, are you working? No.
Right.
Are you... What are you doing? I'm like, watching movies and trying to... It's like, you had such potential. We thought you would be something
right.
by now. And, you know, 25, 26, 27. I'm a shot of... But film, you know, your friends are becoming lawyers and PhDs. And you know,
but you'd already dropped out of school, though.
Yeah. It's like, well, have you thought about getting back in school? I was
right.
like, no, I'm really into what I'm doing, you know. So it wasn't until, like, by the time the movie came out, I was like 29, pushing 30 when Slacker. And it was like, once they see your picture in the paper and an article about the movie, it's like, oh, okay.
Something's happening.
Yeah, that's cool.
It means something.
Yeah. So it's like, so I had that decade of kind of...
Right.
Undetermined. So I have a sympathy for people in their 20s.
Slightly disappointed parents.
Yeah, slightly, but supportive. But
right.
they loved me. I never questioned.
Because there was nothing they can do at that point.
And I wasn't asking them for any money.
Oh, that helps.
That helps. I wasn't, you know.
So they had no control.
They had no technical control. It's just encouragement. But my, you know, the dad gives the advice. Well, you should think about maybe getting back in school or, you know. And my mom was like, oh, honey, you're not asking me for anything. And if... You're not working and you're not in school and you're happy. That sounds great. You know, my mom's a little subversive too. She was kind of
troublemaker.
Yeah, a little. She had that. You know, so she was like, oh, if you can get away with that, that's great. You know, a little bit of stick it to the man.
Yeah.
Oh, attitude.
And you've got a little.
She's
of that.
A little radical.
When did you start? Waking Life wasn't until 2001, huh?
Yeah, it came out. I started that in 99.
Oh, so you've been working on it for a while.
I've been thinking about Waking Life for years and years.
That's
kind of closer to Slacker, actually.
It is. It
structurally.
Is. It is. So what was the idea there?
You know, actually, if you want to put those two movies together, the dream I describe in Slacker, in the monologue at the beginning of the movie, really is Waking Life.
Yeah.
A dream in a way. The idea for Waking Life preceded me even knowing I was a filmmaker.
Right.
It was based on an actual series of lucid dreams I had as a senior in high school.
Is that true?
Yeah, and I thought it was some strange evening, not drug-induced, maybe tension-induced or whatever, but I fell into this thing and just couldn't wake up. but was aware I was dreaming and I was kind of on some quest. And it really stayed with me. And when I finally did wake up, you know, pouring sweat by, you know, I had been asleep for only like 5 minutes, a few minutes.
Sure.
And it was something that always stuck with me. And I was trying to discover what that is. And I did a lot of scientific research and studied about lucid dreaming and what it is and what it is. And even talked to some of the foremost, you know, experts, scientists in that field. So I learned a lot about, you know, the brain science behind it. But for me as a storyteller, I was like, that's a great narrative device. You know, it's an ultimate kind of story, a dream within a dream with the story and the levels. And so I had kind of that had been swimming around as a kind of a story I wanted to, something I wanted to try
and
to
animation
express.
Enabled you to do that?
Exactly. Because it was really boring and pretentious and all that live action. But when I saw the animation technique some friends of mine were working on, were developing there in Austin, some buddies of mine, I was like, you know that film that doesn't work that I've been thinking about for all these years? If it looks like that, it'll work because it's real sound and yet it's clearly a human construct. You know, it's a painting, it's a drawing, and yet it feels real. And that's how dreams are. You know, a dream is, you accept them as reality. It's only when you wake up that you go, oh, wait, I was in a trench in World War One, or, you know, I know somewhere.
And
there was someone there who I know died 10 years ago, but that should have tipped me off that it wasn't real, I accepted it as real. We accept them as real. So I thought, oh, that's an interesting,
and it worked
way to
too.
Tell a story.
You had to adapt to it.
Yeah, you have to. But I love that about movies, though. There's a certain latitude within movies, and I've always believed this. Like, if you set your terms of what the movie is, the audience wants to go there. You just have to be, you have to lay it out and be consistent with it and be clear. And I'm actually, despite all the kind of radical forms around some of my movies, that I'm really trying to tell a pretty clean story, a pretty direct communication of something. And it's often just told in a very different way, but I am trying to communicate, you know, directly.
Yeah.
I like a clean story.
You're not trying to hide anything
or
complicated.
Be too obscure.
Sure.
Like, there's enough complication around. That's like, again, some kind of life. And there's also enough noise, and can we just talk directly?
It's sort of a cop-out, too.
It's hard to do.
To complicate, you know, or to let, you know, or to sort of like, no, I'm not going to resolve that.
I don't appreciate that kind of cleverness because there's, I mean, it can be done well, but I don't like it when someone's toying with me just because they can.
Well, it's, and then like the trilogy that you did, Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, and then Before Midnight.
Right.
Did you know when you did Before Sunrise that this was the plan?
No.
Okay.
No.
Because this is all part of this weird obsession I think you have, a mild obsession with people aging.
Yeah, or
and what
time.
Happens. Time.
Yeah. I mean,
what time does?
I had no idea. I mean, I'm roughly 10 years older than Julie and Ethan, and I was trying to make a film about, you know, two young people who feel this attraction to one another, who have this connection. And that's autobiographical. You know,
it did feel like a foreign film, though, a little bit.
Well, yeah, and it helps that it's in a foreign city. It's very European.
Allowing them to talk.
Yeah,
you know,
more French.
Right, you know, like you mentioned Truffaut.
Yeah, there is like an Eric Rohmer film.
Yeah, definitely, right.
Like two people talking and not much happening and love is in the air.
That's enough.
That's enough. That's how my mind works, you know. And as a filmmaker, it's sort of my own curse, you know. Mm-hmm. Like even I was in my 20s and I met this woman in Philadelphia and we walked the streets all night. You know, it took hours and hours to even kiss. You know, it was like just our minds were firing and we were talking and there was this real connection.
It's great.
Who knows? Is that hormonal? Is it whatever it is?
What happened to that woman?
But even as I was doing that, I was like, I want to make a film about this. And she's like, what are you talking about? I said, just this feeling, you know? So I'm trying to make a film. Years later, I'm trying to make that film about just a feeling.
Was that the line where you kissed her, though?
It wasn't a narrative.
When you said, I want to make a film about, come on.
About, we have to kiss somewhere in here. No, I don't think so. I'm more of like a Woody Allen, Annie Hall. Let's get the first kiss over with right now so we can, you know.
Now let's talk about like, because I was talking to my friend about this too, that you were able to do exactly what you want to do as an artist. And it seems like even the big, huge movies, like School of Rock, now that was a movie, made some money.
Yeah.
A lot of money.
It did pretty well.
So
it didn't feel like we were setting out to make a hit. You know, I was trying to make a cool movie that I would like.
And with you and Mike.
Jack Black and Mike White. We all just, let's make a cool movie. You know, I think
Whose idea was it?
We have a commercial structure. It was Mike White's idea.
Yeah.
You know, he had this vision. He knew Jack.
Yeah.
He had this idea.
Yeah, I've talked to him. I've talked to both of them. Yeah,
yeah. Great guys. And they had this vision for all these kids playing instruments. And I was like, yeah, let's. Had a script, and I just sort of came aboard right at the point it was sort of starting to go the wrong direction, maybe. It was being overdeveloped by the studio. And I kind of, you know, a film needs a director. So I came in, and I think with Mike and Jack, we just said, okay, we've got kind of what we need here. Let's just make it cool. You know, we don't need to end it with them winning the thing and donating the money. You know, it was too overly plotted.
Right.
You know, in a certain way. And so I like to think I came in and sort of, you know, and you know, as a storyteller, you just kind of streamline and make something make sense to you.
Uh-huh.
You know? And so, again, that kind of clear storytelling. A lot of films, they don't even recognize the power of the medium they're working in. They overly explain things. They, oh, why will we care about this character unless his dog has died and his, you know, they overly plot things. That you know, audiences get it. It's called identification. Mm-hmm. You put someone on the screen and spend 5 minutes with them, and I guess that's our hero. And you can use that to crazily subversive ends. Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver. I care about him. Why? Because I'm intimate with him. I see him driving. I feel he's vulnerable. He's a vet. He's writing
in a
diary.
I never thought about
that. But then at some point you go, this guy's a psychotic.
Yeah.
He's out to shoot a presidential candidate and kill some other people that he's judging in an Old Testament fashion. That you know, so this guy, he's not really a good citizen, is he?
Right.
But we like him. You know, Tony Perkins in Psycho.
Right.
He's already killed, or, you know, he's dispensing of, you know, the car.
Yeah.
And it's in the quicksand or that pit, and it almost sinks. And the audience, we go, once it goes under, we're like, we're relieved. You know, Hitchcock's really twisted that way. So we're now on the side of the bad guy.
Yeah.
You know, like film's powerful in senses of identification.
Sure.
So you don't need a whole bunch of background. You don't need to explain everything. People are with it. We're humans relating to other humans.
It.
And we, you don't.
Right.
So films spend, and this is, you know, most scripts, the first 20, 30 pages where they're trying to explain and build up and all these studio notes about why should we care about them? What are the stakes? You know, just get to it. You know, just get to it. You know,
and people make up their own mind. Right.
Yeah.
Don't overexplain.
It's a powerful medium. You don't need to.
Oh, boy, you see some bad movies that just never stop overexplaining.
Oh, yeah. Well, they have to, because that's why I've kind of largely avoided plot driven. I just don't think that way.
Right.
And what I've largely done, I think, if I had to analyze it, would replace like plot machinations, you know, with structures to do with time, you know, because that's how we process the world, you know, in our own worlds, our lives we're living. And so I've kind of replaced one for the other. But one to me is very true to life. Like people get it.
Yeah.
Oh, it's you're going to shoot this and it'll be 85 minutes of real time walking around Paris. Okay, I understand that because I've spent 85 minutes walking around today, you know? So it's not hard to crack that as a structure. You just have to make it compelling and believable.
But that's what I just remember that was an interesting thing about Boyhood, is that there were moments where you got the groove, you got that we were in the simple life of just people, you know, going through life. But there were moments where you thought, like, this, something's going to go down.
Oh, it's about to happen. Yeah. I never, that's crazy to me. And it shows, I never
Wait,
knew.
Wait, you heard that before?
Yeah, no. The first screening we had, and, you know, I had shot the movie. And we made, you know, the actors, we all were so surprised when we were sitting there at Sundance with 1,200 people in the theater. And this is, I'm thinking, like, the scene where they're farting around, throwing saw blades at the walls, at sheetrock at a teenage camping trip.
Right.
And there's these blades around, there's kids hanging.
That's the scene.
You feel the audience I heard a chill.
Right.
And we're like an hour and 20 minutes into the movie at this point, or hour and halfway through the movie. And I felt this chill. I go, oh my God, they think something's about to happen. And it had never crossed my mind, never. As the creator and my actors, we never even talked about it. But I said, oh wow, that's so interesting. We're so conditioned
That's it.
To think, okay, why would we be watching a movie unless something extraordinary happens? You know,
I felt that that was exactly the scene.
Yeah. And then there's later, like the dad says, hey, no driving and texting. And then he's driving with his girlfriend and she shows him a text and a picture of a little pig. And
yeah,
he's driving and actually looking at the phone. So you think, okay, here's where the car goes off the road. But the truth is, you know, we all drive and look at our devices and hope we don't get in wrecks.
Right.
And what's frustrating is when you get ahead of a movie.
Yeah.
You know, the horror film, like, really, don't. How about locking the door? You know, whatever, when they're doing dumb things on screen. So I wanted the problems of Boyhood to be, feel like real to life, like, you know, the kind of life.
All right.
The
so
problems we confront and try to resolve best we can. And
I like
get
that.
Over, you know.
I like that she remains, like, the mother character is somewhat unapologetic.
Yeah.
And I think that was a good decision. That, you know, you sort of, she comes, she's clearly there for the kids, has her own problems, but, you know, her life, she's a good mother.
Yeah, she loves her kids and she's trying.
Right,
but is she a good mother?
She's going to have a life.
Yeah, yeah. That's how it felt in my household. It's like, you know, my mom was my mom. She, you
right.
know, and there weren't a lot of looking back.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
there wasn't a lot of introspection. It's like, oh, well,
yeah,
that right. didn't work out.
Or if you have you ever come up to her with the sort of like, why didn't you, or why how come?
I'm afraid
really?
To ask that. I'm kind of non-confrontational.
Wow.
I think my sisters have. My
what'd
sisters.
They get?
Oh, you know, little all crying and emotional. You know, it's like, but I think once we were all older and had kids, my sister, you start judging your parents differently. And they were like, well, why did we do that? Or how did that happen? Or what? You know, you start, you have this... Like I was saying, this generational lag of communication and
what are you finding?
Thoughts.
We never got to that. What are you finding your relationship with your mother is now and with your kids? And
you know, just, you know, you're kind of...
Is she better with
resolved,
the grandkids?
Yeah, resolved. Right. You know, it's like, yeah, it's what it was. That's the way I am with almost every element of my life. It's like, yeah, those are the cards you're dealt. You did the best you can. That's your hand. Make the best of it. Don't look back. You know.
I don't know, but you process it in a 2-hour-plus movie. You know, I mean, you're processing those emotions.
Sure, I am. And maybe that's, you know, there was some trauma in childhood. It wasn't, I mean, I think we all feel traumatized just as humans in this world. Just trying to, every psyche is extremely complex, and it's really hard to just make it through the world, no matter what. You know, where you start from.
But you had, from your point of view, when you were a kid at that age, that guy that your mom was dating in the movie, I don't want to keep saying your, but in the movie, was a guy you dealt with.
Sure.
So on some level, you know, that to me, no matter who you are, sure, you know, life is what it is. There's the cards you dealt, but that's a violent environment.
Sure.
And it's a frightening environment. And when you're 10.
Intimidating. When you're 8, 9, 10, 12.
It can be devastating because, like, you got your real dad, and then you got this stranger.
I know.
Who your mom.
Who wanders. He wanders into your. This is. Stepmothers can fall in the same. You know, there's a whole, you know, Cinderella thing. Like, ooh, watch out for stepmothers, too. Because suddenly there's this adult authority figure in life exerting control and opinions over you. And. Wow, like, I didn't invite you here.
And you're not my dad.
And you're not my biological anything, and I'm not even going to call you dad, you know? I'm sorry, because you're not my dad.
Right.
And yet, you're in my house.
I can't, like, I don't think I ever really registered what that must have been like as much in empathetically until I saw your movie.
I talked to a woman last night just at a function. She came up to me and thanked me for that. She goes, I don't think I've seen that in a movie where the multi-household, the new parents, like that, what it feels like to go back and forth and have new. Yeah, it's not. I mean, there's some dramatic moments, but it's just also like, well, that's the life you adapt to because you're just adapting to your
parents.
Because
you're a kid.
New,
you can't, right.
surroundings. And kids are amazingly adaptable.
Sure.
You know, you read these studies about like homeless kids.
Sure.
Like, hey, we're living in a cardboard box under a freeway. And the kids are like, okay, let's go. The grocery store is where the cardboard is. Let's go. We'll go out and get it when it quits raining. And they're very adaptable. Like it's as a species. And they're kind of like, let's get together and make this work.
But clearly your parents were stable enough because you've got your shit together.
And yeah, and so do my sisters, you know.
Right.
So,
you know, and your mom, that was the integrity of that character, and obviously of your mother, is that she may be stubborn, mm-hmm. and she may have made bad choices, but she's certainly going to look out for you.
Yeah, at the end, we were always going to kind of pull through. I mean, do you have a choice, you know, but yeah, it felt that way.
So, Fast Food Nation, I love that book. I enjoyed the movie a lot. It must have been a hard thing to figure out what the hell the story was going to be from that book.
Yeah, that was, you know, Eric Schlosser and I got to talking, and he's like, you know, what would the movie from this book be? I said, well, wouldn't it be a documentary, you know? And eventually, years later, they did make a movie kind of called Food Inc.
Yeah.
That was, you know, it's not based on Fast Food Nation, Eric was involved in it.
Sure.
But our job, and I was like, well, I tell stories, you know, I'm a character guy. I'm you know, like working with actors. And so we were talking about dramatizing stories within that non-fictional environment,
right,
that would tell the story in a different way, you know. So that was a challenge to adapt that material, but it was really fun to kind of see the multi sides of like the fast food meal. You know, you got the executives, you got the immigrant labor, you've got the teenager working at the place, and you know, it's a fun way to tell a story.
How'd you feel about that movie?
Challenging. I like it. It was that, and I did that, and Scanner Darkly came out around the same time. And looking back on it, it's like those are both really kind of dark, bleak, strange stories. And I think that was what was going on in my head at that time. It was like Bush Cheney era grimness.
You know? Grew up with those guys.
Yeah,
at least the Bushes.
We endured that decade, that time. It was a tough century. The first chunk of it for a lot of people. I feel sorry for kids.
Yeah.
At least I was, you know, an adult.
When did you start going to Austin?
Oh, as a teenager. I visited some older friends there and kind of thought, oh, this seemed like a pretty, you know, you go to some music at the Continental Club, you go to Barton Springs, and there's half-naked girls running around. You're like, hey, I could live here.
So it was always like that. It was always a little groovy.
It was a big music scene. The film scene, they had a big film school there, but the film scene was kind of marginal. When I got there, and it's been one of the great, you know, parts of my life to be a part of a film world that's kind of growing there culturally.
Didn't you create the Austin Film Society?
Yeah, but almost 30 years ago.
It's 30 years?
We started in 85.
What was
started showing movies.
Is that what the original intention was?
Yeah, we just showed a lot of movies you couldn't see on campus or anywhere else in town.
What was the venue?
The Dobie Theater, the extinct Dobie Theater. They let us show at midnight, and I just walked in there and talked to the manager. Hey, I want to show these movies, and we'll split the money. And I was so passionate about film, and I was making my own films then, but I kind of wanted to do something, you know. I had a bigger calling about cinema, and I still do, you know. We give out grants, we show a ton of movies. I still host film series. You know, I'm not doing the grunt work like I did all those years. I'm not.
Like
writing the grants and booking the films and shipping. And that was you know, even in my non-productive 20s, I did start a nonprofit organization that's still around and is a major.
Does
nonprofit.
It have its own venue now?
Yeah. Yeah. The Marquesa there. Yeah. We've got our own 200 plus seat theater and show movies there and film.
Every day?
We're finding the good fight. Yeah. We show 20 something a month.
Yeah.
We've given out like 1.5, you know, 4 or 5 million in grants to filmmakers around the state, and I'm as proud of the Film Society and what it's become and what we've accomplished than, you know, my own films.
Yeah,
it's been a wonderful parallel life that I can put time into, you know.
And do you when you give out grants and stuff? How do you decide? Do you decide?
Oh, we have
on
some panelists
works?
From out of state who they go through proposals and work samples, and you know, people need encouragement. You know, the culture really doesn't care about art.
Yeah,
and often the artists themselves, young artists in particular, haven't always had the family encouragement. So I've found that, and it happened in my life. I got a grant for, you know, $2,600 to help me finish Slacker.
And you did?
I parlayed that into getting family to loan me money to finish. And, you know, so sometimes that's the first, like, affirmative shot in the arm you've ever had as an artist. Like, hey, good effort.
Yeah.
So it's even beyond the money. It's, I think, the notion that the bigger world cares, and that they want to support an artist, because the culture is can be kind of cruel to artists. I don't think we put enough emphasis on it. It's always the first thing cut from schools, and
sure,
it's seen as a sidebar. But I really think, you know, art and creativity, it will save us. You know,
it's so important
for the human soul and for the culture, and it's the worst.
It's bad, and teachers.
Horrible, and we so undervalue the absolute most important things, because you can't do the math and find a place for it in the marketplace. But it's the ultimate thing that will save us all.
I don't think
education
people...
and feelings and sensitivity and and the culture it's never been any better. It's better in other places in the world than it is the United States, the winner take all capitalist, you know, when they can't find a bottom line place for something,
doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, oh, well, do we even need that?
Yeah.
You know, do we really need, let's zero out the NEA, you know, a bunch of elitists.
It's crazy.
You know, it's insane. You couldn't do a worse investment to cut stuff like that.
Yeah. And the thing is that as things go away, it becomes harder to find, and you need things like what you're doing to provoke the people that are like us, that you're wandering around when you're 15 and like, this looks cool. I want to know about that.
I know. I've enjoyed just in boyhood. Like, there's been some really younger teenage viewers to see thing and see them spring up like, oh, wow, like that. You know, to feel like you've kind of jumped into someone's life and jostled them around a little bit. I never think that way when I'm doing anything. But when you see the result and you see some kid kind of going, oh, wow, that was like a lot like my life. And it makes me think about my mom and my dad and my.
It's great.
And I'm like, oh, that's cool, because that kind of stuff sure inspired me. You know, I live for those moments when I felt connected to something far, far away from me, but through art, you know,
sure.
It made me think the world was an okay place, and there was a place for me in it.
Do you draw some sort of line where are there movies that you do for money?
No,
not really.
I never have. No, I haven't had to.
Right.
I keep a low overhead, and I've never done a movie that I wasn't super like. Thinking I was the only person who could do that. Even someone like School of Rock is a good example.
Well, people love that movie. I'm not begrudging that movie, but the remake of The Bad News Bears, what was it?
But I came from the exact same place I came from School of Rock, which was like, this movie seems to be happening. It's the only two times I've kind of come aboard a project that I didn't originate.
Right.
And, you know, that's kind of what our industry is.
Right.
And in both cases, I felt like, well, it seemed like that movie was going to get made with or without me. But I felt called to, like, I'm the kind of the right guy to do it,
because
I know that subject so well. In School of Rock, it was that character, Jack's character, Dewey Finn, was kind of me in a parallel world.
Right.
And the rock and roll, you know, that was me. Music's such a big part of my life, and I felt I knew. And I had a daughter just that age at that moment, so I felt a sensitivity to fifth graders at that moment. So I thought, you know, all the roads lead to me being the best guy to do this movie. I have to feel like I'm the only, because if anyone can do it, I shouldn't do it. And I've turned down plenty of movies over the years that I think are better movies because someone else directed it.
Right.
Like, I wasn't the right sensibility. So the industry, there's a lot of matchmaking going on. There's all these stories, you know, maybe an adapted book, a remake, you know, whatever. And they're just matchmaking for the right sensibility. And a smart producer or studio head might get that, you know.
Right.
In School of Rock, it was Scott Rudin, the producer, who kind of started pestering me to do it. And I said no at first, and then he convinced me that it was going to be a good creative experience, which it was. You know, I was kind of afraid of maybe that you hear the horror stories like, oh, you know, some bad Hollywood experience. But I sit before you having not had a bad experience. Like, both those are big movies for me. They're like $30 million, which is a low budget studio film, believe it or not, but for me it's a bigger film. But
and you feel that
it's great to have those resources, though.
Right,
I got 50 days to shoot the film.
Do you feel the pressure,
15.
Though? Do you get?
I don't. You know, as a former athlete, I don't really accept the pressure.
See, that's what makes a director.
I don't let it get to me.
That's what makes a director a director.
Pressure's a choice. I don't. Meh.
Pressure's a choice.
I don't see it as that. I saw it as an opportunity. I thought I could take what I do, what I thought was my own working methodologies, and take it to a studio level. And frankly, it's a big challenge to make a studio comedy. You know, I see a lot of comedies and I go, it's funny, but they left a lot of humor on the table.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think comedy's a craft.
Yeah.
You know, you really work it and you you make it work and you rehearse and you, you know, I brought a methodology and a lot of thinking to, you know, certain comedies. So,
but that's not innately your thing, is it?
No, I mean, on one level, in both those cases, it was like a perfect little moment in my life where I could do it.
Sure.
If I was offered either of those today, I wouldn't because I'm doing other things.
You're excited. You had a kid that was around that age.
Yeah, and I felt kind of like I got to feel. And it was the first time I said yes to something that, you know, I was like, well, I'm a little older. I could, if it didn't end up a good experience, I could live with it. It wouldn't mess up my trajectory of what I think I'm here to do.
Pressure is a choice. Is that something you learned in high school athletics?
It's kind of a thing a coach tells you. A smart coach.
Is that where you heard it?
But not, I heard it more recently. I didn't hear it when I needed to hear it. I know. I made a documentary about a very interesting coach at the University of Texas, and that's a kind of a thing he would say.
Uh-huh. What documentary was that?
It was called Inning by Inning, Portrait of a Coach. Augie Garrido, the kind of the greatest college baseball coach, the most winningest coach in NCAA history. But that's not what he's about. He's kind of a Zen master and has a lot to say about the metaphors of the game and life. And I mean, he's just a cool old guy.
You're kind of a Zen guy.
Yeah, I actually related to what a head coach goes through is a lot like what a film director goes through. You're sort of seeing greatness in others and trying to maximize their skills, whether it's an actor, a composer, a production designer, a costume designer.
You've also got to keep your shit together for everybody.
Yeah, and then you have to be kind of a central authority orchestrator of all this creative energy and abilities.
Uh-huh.
And so that's an ability in itself. You know, a lot of directors were kind of, you maybe don't possess, like none of us could be as good at actors, but you know a lot about acting. You know, I know just enough. And same with every element of filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's people who specialize more in all of it, but I feel like I know, you know.
Do you,
I know what I'm going for.
Sure. Well, clearly.
You have to.
Yeah. Do you hang out with the other Austin guys? Like when Mike Judge was there, were you guys hanging out?
Yeah.
What about Rodriguez?
Old friend. Yeah. See him. You know,
Robert?
Everybody's kind of doing their own thing. But yeah.
Robert's got a whole operation out there.
He's a mogul. He's amazing. He's an amazing guy, you know? So I'm always kind of awed by Robert's, you know, just sheer energy and creativity.
Do you use his facilities ever?
Every now and then. And he uses our, we're kind of next door neighbors.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he has a studio right next to the Film Society. So we're neighbors, brothers, you know, all the way down the line. Been friends for a long time.
That's great.
Yeah.
And what about Mike?
Yeah, Mike, he used to be in Austin more. I think he's out here a little more.
Yeah, he's back out here.
But no, just a genius, you know. And one of the funniest, like, lunch companions you'll ever, you know, like, his imitations,
man,
that guy is, he's unbelievable.
He comes from Albuquerque.
Yeah.
Weren't you in one of the Beavis, but you were in the movie, weren't you?
Yeah, I was doing imitations, you know, of like a high school football coach. And he liked the way I kind of imitated one of them. Like, how some old guys kind of hit this upper register, especially Southern guys.
Yeah.
I'm warning you, you better, you know, they hit this register that, what? That's not your voice. But when they get angry.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think he thought it was funny. But he asked me to come in the studio and play a bus driver who beats the shit out of like Beavis or something.
Yeah.
So it was just fun.
And so I like that you guys have a community down there. And
yeah. And there's a pretty ton of other like indie directors making really excellent films. Yeah, Austin, it's...
Anybody program that you...
Oh, yeah, quite... Yeah, a lot.
Yeah?
A lot, you know.
Any guys doing features yet?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. No, tons. At Sundance every year, there's like numerous features
from Austin Film Society? Grants?
Yeah, and a lot of them are former grantees and people who, you know, like right out of college, they stayed there and they, you know, made a film and made their next film. And, you know, I could list quite a few.
Well, geez, man, it's great talking to you. You're doing great stuff, and I love the new film. It was like nothing I'd seen before. And,
well, thank you. Well, that's high praise to just, you know, trying to do something you haven't seen before. So that's what it felt like to me. I was definitely making a film I hadn't made before.
Yeah. So. And it was great talking to you, man. I'll see you in Austin.
All right, man.
All right, buddy.
And we never talked about Phil Lynott and Thin Lizzy.
We can.
No, it's
cool. We can still do it.
He's just an amazing guy. I mean, he's this black Irish dude with a big fro.
Yeah.
Who's...
dude, nobody sounds like him, man.
Rock and roll in that voice.
Nobody sounds like Phil Lynott. Nobody.
You know, and One of the most beautiful songs he ever did is called Still in Love with You. Do you know that song?
Yes.
Oh, it's a most beautiful ballad. He could do anything. Yeah.
Who was your main high school bands?
Wow. From where I started high school, like, you know, FM Top 40, Leonard Skinner, Zeppelin, Aerosmith, and where I ended was like Zappa, Beefheart, King Crimson.
Really?
Yeah. I had my own little...
I had a kind of a weird similar arc. So you had the mainstream shit.
Yeah.
And then I met the dude who worked at the record store, and then I was into Bowie.
Yeah, like, what are you doing?
The Residents.
Residents. Have you heard of this guy, Brian Eno?
Right, Eno was another one.
It was a great time. There was all this experimentation.
Hey, you had to have a guy show you that shit, though.
The guy who owned Evolution Records in Huntsville, Texas, this little, in a little conservative town, a record store called Evolution, which is challenging their belief system alone.
It's not the place where Britt Daniel grew up. Is it the guy from Spoon?
No, he grew up in a town, Taylor, which is I believe it's Taylor.
Yeah, that's right.
Similar experience. You're the weird guy, but there's always that little nook you can hang out. That's why the
Evolution
Records. Yeah, right there in Huntsville, Texas.
He was the dude, right? Yeah. Brian Eno.
And there were always guys. You know, they're like, hey, have you checked out? It's great. You know, it's just so important. But I guess people do that online now. I mean, right?
I don't know, man. Like, it's just like, I don't know.
Friends, like someone you don't really know and you can show your interest and they can take
you. It seems like there's a little more of a sort of like one-upsmanship going on. And there's sort of, as opposed to like actually sharing, it's like you can go look at anything you want online and get access to it. But to actually be standing before a dude that's usually a little older than you.
Yeah, you look
know
up.
Shit.
They have taste. They're 10 years older than you.
They know
They've
shit.
They've been through shit.
Secret shit. Yeah. The secret shit, because Beefheart, that's secret shit.
Yeah, that's like, it's secret. You're not going
to... Yeah, it's Zappa, like to be like, introduced into that world.
Like,
did you?
Oh, you like Zappa? Well, have you ever heard Trout Mask West? Yeah. Replica. Zappa produced it. It's like, okay.
Yeah.
A new tree branch forms.
Oh my God, I just got into that branch. It took me up until last year, 2 years ago.
Really? Yeah.
You were into Zappa when you were a teenager?
Teenager, yeah.
Did you like heavy in?
Into college, yeah. Once I went in, I went way in. I'm one of those freaks. I have every album.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
That's
and when I was younger, it was, you know, Beatles, Stones, you know, like
you got all that. That's like Christmas carols, man. They're in place.
They're in place. They're not going anywhere and they're great.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But.
Yeah, then the Zappa universe, someone gives you that. But Brian Eno, too, it's like, what the fuck?
Yeah, like,
and the Residents and that whole world?
Yeah.
All that art rock going on?
Yeah.
So you had your mind blown.
Art rock. And then, you know, and then it got more punky and more new wave punky, you know, pretty soon.
I saw that happen,
I discovered that.
You were already out of high school. Like, that started coming in, like, the new wave stuff. Like, I was still, because you graduated, what?
In 79.
Right. So I graduated in 81. Mm-hmm. So those last couple of years, shit started changing.
Oh, yeah.
There's some skinny ties on the quad.
Oh, it changed.
Yeah.
It changed rapidly. You know, this movie, I just shot a movie that'll be out probably next summer, fall or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's set in 1980. It's about a college freshman. You just show up at college and you're listening to Van Halen, but you go to discos to chase women. But then, you know, you end up at a punk club or a country bar because the Urban Cowboy was big.
That was right.
It was all on the table. Like some of that stuff.
That's great. That's great.
So it's an interesting cultural moment because then they go to an art party and they're listening to the Talking Heads.
That's fucking fascinating, dude.
So it's a cultural moment where...
That's what...
It was all on the table. And I'm like, who am I? Am I a punk? Am I a new wave? Am I heavy metal? Am I...
You knew disco was dying, though.
Well, disco sucked anyway, but you secretly, I'm amazed how that stuff has aged. Like, I explained to my cast, because they go, I'm all these young guys who weren't nowhere near even being born then. And they were liking all this disco music. I said, okay, let me tell you, I secretly like the beats and the way some of it felt, but as a thinking rock and roller, you could never admit it. You had to say this stuff sucked.
You can say it now. I listen to Donna Summer now.
Yeah.
I listen to...
I kind of rediscovered all this stuff. And it just seems so
that
shallow.
That song, like, Don't Leave Me This Way with that bass line.
It's kind of great. But the shallowness of it was kind of projected onto it because you knew it was kind of disposable. They'd go into a studio. Often it was producer-based. They'd get some singers and beats. And, you know, it's kind of like the worst of rap. You know, but it's kind of like it wasn't artistry and the lyrics were often very simple, but it was there were hooks and beats and
tell me about this juncture though, because I've been sort of fascinated with that, because that's unique to our generation.
Yeah.
We're not the 60s. We're not old boomers. We were literally in high school when like the 60s was fading.
It was over.
Zeppelin was established.
Yeah.
But still, that was even old by the time we were in high school. We were there for In Through the Outdoor and maybe Presence. You were in, right?
Sure.
But then all of a sudden, you know, New Wave came in and punk actually hit the States after New Wave for some reason where I lived.
Yeah, it was slow. Things weren't instantaneous. What was going on in London and New York was years away.
Right, and then like when I was like I worked across from the University of New Mexico, so I knew artists. I knew the art rock thing because of the guy at the record store. Yeah. But you still had Van Halen.
Yeah,
like I was still in high school. I mean, when Van Halen 1 came out,
I'm going to that concert.
Right, but it was all there.
Yeah,
and you and I tell a story. Right, it might even be in my book about bringing my buddy Dave, who was my friend who owned a fucking Firebird, to this college party where this band was doing performance art.
Yeah.
And it was that moment where he was like, I guess it's cool, is there beer? You know, like that.
You just wander in like, oh.
Well, I knew sort of what was up, and I'm like, Dave's never going to get this.
Yeah.
But, you
performance
know,
art.
Yeah, but he
what
was
is
all
that?
Right. Yeah. But so what?
Minds are blown.
Right. What compelled you?
That's what college is about.
Was that the context that you were dealing with? Was that the only thing that entered this film for you? Was that that weird vortex of shifting?
And trying to figure out who you are. And it's autobiographical, too. You know, like I was that college kid showing up and with some ideas and being introduced, like meeting. I remember meeting, you know, actors and an actress and like gay guys in the drama department. I'm like, well, they're gay. Like, I didn't think I knew any gay people.
Sure.
And I was like, wow.
And they don't seem to have a problem with it.
Yeah. But I was like, they're really cool. Look how smart and creative. Yeah. And I like what they're, you know, I was like, oh, wow. Like worlds were just opening. And,
right.
Yeah. It was just mind blowing and cool people who didn't give a shit about the pep rally or sports or, you know, what seems to rule high schools.
And this is,
and it was like, oh, ideas, art, energy, creativity.
So what's the name of this
you're
film?
You're 18, 19 years old. And working title is, that's what I'm talking about. And that's, it's a
How
group
far
of,
along are you?
I'm starting to edit. I just shot it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I had a nice little gap this fall. And, you know.
Who's playing
33 days of production. A wonderful ensemble. It's a lot like Days, the big ensemble of young actors, none of which you probably know.
Now, this is exciting.
A lot of guys have been around, and you might recognize a few from, you know, guys from, you know, young actors. They're in all kinds of stuff.
I'm excited.
But it's fun. I'm excited about
How's
it.
How's the footage
good,
look?
Good, great. You know, good energy. You know, disco footage, punk club. The last night we shot like a punk club.
Yeah.
And I had a group, a local group, Riverboat Gamblers in Austin, a really excellent, excellent like punk band. And they did, as I remember, I told them like, can you do a punk song of the Gilligan's Island theme song? Because I remember a band in the 80s doing that.
Sure.
And damn it, if they did, they did. It starts off kind of a ballad, then boom. And
they nailed it?
Yeah, it was awesome. And I did another couple other punk songs in there.
I remember going through Austin when I graduated college in like 86 or 87. I was there and I saw a band. I was shit-faced. And I saw a band do like a punk rock Rose of San Antone.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, that was the first time I'd heard that song. And I'm like, that's the greatest song
that's
in the
great.
World.
It's like, oh, you know, there's a traditional version of that.
No, doesn't exist.
Nah,
I have it though. I have the Bob Wills version.
But
is
just
that one?
Yeah. But just that idea of taking something from your cultural past and revamping it, reusing it. I was like, oh, that's brilliant.
I'm excited.
You can do that in every art form. You can take all this crap you were fed and turning it into something else.
I'm excited about this movie.
So yeah, me too. It fits right in there. It's like college. It sort of begins right where Boarhead ends. A guy shows up at college. So it's
great.
It's an overlap.
It's right the same there. Kid?
No, it wasn't, because that kid's kind of an artist kid, and my guys are sort of jocks. They're all on the baseball team, but they're like witty. You know, people think athletes are kind of dumb, and some are, but there was a certain kind of energy and wit among, particularly the older guys. They were like, so it's kind of trying to capture, they're competitive jerks on one hand, but they're really funny and witty on another.
And you're the one whose mind gets blown?
A little bit. There's several freshmen coming
right.
in. But, you know, hold your own. You got to kind of
hold
your own with these guys.
All right.
So that's the challenge to stick in there. But we'll see, you know, check it out.
I'm excited, man. Great talking to you.
Yeah,
we
really
did it.
Fun.
We got Thin Lizzy in.
We got Thin Lizzy.
All right, folks, that's it. That's our show. I hope you enjoyed that conversation. Very nice guy, and I like the fact that he's giving back to the world, helping people out. Oh, my God. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Get the app. Upgrade to the premium app. Oh, my God. I am tired of me. Lives.